You're going to have to break one of my toes, I explained. Lorianne and I were sunning ourselves in the tiny, fenced-in patio of my mother's house on thin towels laid directly over the hot, cracked pavement. We had each squeezed a plastic lemon from the supermarket into our hair and were praying to be blonder, always blonder, our eyes closed against the sun. There was jasmine on the wind. In the narrow cove of our 90s California neighborhood, there was no girl more perfect than Lorianne Swift, not so much because she was extraordinary, but because she was ordinary in a way that surpassed us. Her parents loved her, and she loved them. In fact, it was difficult to even get an invitation to their house. So much did they prefer one another's company to the company of outsiders. Even her older brother, instead of cruelly taunting her or running her over with his bike, shared his CD collection and advised her on her breaststroke. Most of our parents had wound up in the sleepy ocean hamlet of Corona del Mar through a series of increasingly devastating mistakes. The Southern California real estate market, which had seemed throughout the 80s to have no ceiling, had suddenly crashed, and many fathers were now stay-at-home dads whose time was divided equally between the bottle and the couch, an ice pack over their eyes, as their wives scrambled to become certified dental hygienists. One girl, Miranda, had a mother who worked at Disneyland during the day and then worked all night from home as a telephone hotline psychic. "It pays better even than phone sex," Miranda reported one afternoon as we licked sugar-free orange jello powder from tiny saucers. I remember, too, that they had four extremely aged Rottweilers, two of whom had lost control of their bowels. Mostly, our parents had assumed that life would be self-explanatory, and that, bright and eager as they were, they ought to be able to handle it just fine. This faith, a faith in their own capableness, was gradually leaving them and being replaced, at least in the case of my own mother, with an interest in the occult and a steady red wine habit. Some have characterized the boomers as optimistic, but to my view, they were simply soft and rather unprepared. They didn't know how to cook or sew or balance their own checkbooks. They were bad at opening the mail. They got headaches while trying to lead Girl Scout meetings, and they sat down in folding chairs with their fingers pinching the bridges of their noses, trying not to cry over how boring and hard life had turned out to be, as around them, feverish little girls screamed with laughter over the fact that one of them had stepped in poop. Lorianne's parents were not losing faith, though. They were living in some other, better world. They went to church every Sunday. They rented classic horror movies every Friday night, and even Lorianne's older brother, then 16, stayed in to watch as they ordered Domino's and made popcorn in the tiny one-bedroom apartment all four of them shared. Her father, Terry, had an earring, a big golden hoop like a pirate's, and wore a black silk top hat to parent-teacher night. He was a Christian rock musician, and Lorianne's mother, Dana, was a preschool teacher who collected gnomes, ceramic and wooden gnomes of all sizes and styles, standing on the floor and on tables and shelves, their backs to the wall, their dull eyes turned on the center of the room. Certainly, it seemed to me, Lorianne would never have been stupid enough to get pregnant in 10th grade by a boy she didn't even like, which was precisely what I had done. And yet, the spring I was 15, it was Lorianne who came with me to get the abortion, who helped me to plan it all out. She had already turned 16 and gotten her license, but I didn't just need her as my driver. I needed her, in all her goodness and her primness, to forgive me, to give her consent by participating in my scheme.